it will be the Kansas City Fed's 42nd annual meeting in Jackson Hole and Jerome Powell's first meeting as chair, also coming just before the 10-year anniversary of the financial crisis. The unwind from the crisis will be high on the list of issues for Powell, who will speak Friday morning on, quote, monetary policy in a changing economy. He has that right.
Well, looking at the oil market, it has declined. We have not seen a $70 day for the whole month of August. So that is interesting in itself, that it's been essentially a straight down move with lower highs and lower lows. So what we've seen here this week is a dip. We're down about $1.50 for the week. But I would attribute a lot of this to the dollar. We just made some new one-year highs in the dollar. But let's pay attention here, because we are, depending on how we finish today, in position for a new high with a lower weekly close, which could be the start of a dollar stall that would help out all commodity markets.
We saw the Shanghai Composite drop another 1.3%, and that now brings the index down to a 2.5-year low. And as you said, there is nothing but bad news for this market.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
China back at the negotiating table, strong earnings, and the price of oil dips, not reaching 70 for the entire month of August. And coming up at the end of the month, the Fed's conclave in Jackson Hole, where they will be talking about on the 10th anniversary of the financial crisis, a topic we've long discussed here on the Financial Sense News Hour, which is financial concentration of large firms. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in Hour 1 will be my good friend, Ralph Ancampora. Ralph still thinks this secular bull market has legs, although we may have some cyclical downturns in between. We'll talk about the difference in the divergence in the Dow. What does that mean? We'll talk also about FANG stocks in the first crack that we're starting to see, and some great sage advice for those dividend stocks that you own. He'll be having some great things to say. He'll be joining me in Hour 1. Later on, Keith Barron will be joining me as we take a look at this gold market. Gold has a lot more competition today, whether it's cryptocurrencies or cannabis stocks in Canada. But the mere fact is, we're finding less and less gold, fewer gold discoveries, and the discoveries we're making, they're getting smaller and smaller. So what happens to the price of gold? What will be the catalyst? Well, it may be coming from the supply front. And if you're investing in gold, where's the best place to find to put your money if you want to be in precious metals? He'll be joining me, and of course, Ryan Poplava will be here as we talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm Chris Prytower. In the second hour, Chris Poplava and Ryan Poplava will engage in an in-depth discussion about United States resiliency in light of all of the current pain points. For example, Turkey, Italy, China. How long will this apparent immunity last? It should be a very interesting conversation, so be sure to stay tuned for the second hour of The Big Picture. Well, each week we have Ryan Poplava join us to give us sort of an encapsulated view of the markets and those things nationally and internationally that drive the markets. And last week we left off, Ryan, with a sizable drop in the Turkish lira and world markets waking up to the idea of a possible currency crisis there. As a result of that hiccup, there's been more media coverage over Argentina, the Chinese yuan, etc. Is the currency being defended, as Turkey said? In fact, I've got an article here. I want to read this quote. Turkey said, "From Monday onwards, our institutions will take the necessary steps." So is the currency being defended as they suggest, or do the markets want to see more from them? And with the dollar breaking out, is this only the beginning?
Well, Chris, typically what shores up a currency is central banks tightening policy. The other step that you typically also see is maybe some backing financially. So typically that's the IMF assistance. Or lastly, there is one more. I mean, we could see capital controls where they essentially say money's not allowed to leave the country or money's not allowed to come in the country. But like you said, we got the I guess you could call it the bumblebee speech, essentially from Turkey, in reference to Mario Draghi back during the sovereign debt crisis situation. They said basically they'll do whatever it takes. Now, the proof is always in the pudding. Let's just see what they implement. And that's where we need to go, because there's, I guess I can go into it a little bit later. There's some great divide between what the central bank needs to do and what their president wants to not see happen, which is rates going up. There was an official meeting during the week where they announced an agreement to work on essentially fiscal responsibility. To battle their 16% inflation rate, their central bank really has to raise rates. And they have to do it by quite a bit. I think I read somewhere that someone thinks between 500 to 800 basis points from where things are at right now. Obviously, that's just subjective. But in May alone, they raised rates around 300 basis points. But here we are in August. That just didn't seem to stem the tide. Inflation continues to be rising. Now, look at how much Greece had to do with their similar situation. They not only did a lot of capital controls, they tried to do as much as they could to reprice some of their debt, maybe get a haircut. But what they essentially did do is austerity, which means that they cut back on fiscal spending. As I said, just many other measures to really balance their fiscal condition. Like I said, is really an aversion who says that high interest rates are the mother and father of all evil. So instead this week, they raised rates indirectly because, again, there's that aversion to actually raising interest rates. The central bank has their short-term overnight borrowing rates at around 19.25% versus their longer window of 1 week, which is lower at 17.75%. So what they're doing is forcing any kind of short-term withdrawals at a much higher rate. There's a bit of a penalty with the timing of that. So a bit of a mini inversion, if you will. So there are many academics that think this won't work because the market believes the central bank isn't serious enough to raise rates high enough to stem that inflation. And then going back to their president, who thinks high rates are the cause, not the effect of inflation, you can see the real battle here. And I think that battle will be between the central bank and their president could eventually cause this whole event to go on longer than it probably needs to.
Well, Ryan, I want to bring up the C word, contagion. I was looking at an article just a few days ago in the Wall Street Journal, which mentioned that markets have panicked if other countries share the same economic weaknesses. It mentioned South Africa and what happened in 1985 when the South African president defied international financiers. It really didn't have an impact outside of South Africa, but they also compare that during the Asian financial crisis of 97-98, which began with Thailand burning through its foreign currency reserves, that it really did impact Malaysia, Philippines, South Korea, Indonesia, etc. So I am assuming we need to continue to read the headlines on Turkey and what's going on there. But Ryan, will you be talking more about this in the big picture with your brother Chris?
Very much so, because that's one of the near-term tactical issues that this market's dealing with. And, you know, we want to really highlight the possibilities of a currency crisis transforming into a full-blown sovereign solvency crisis, like what happened to Greece. You mentioned Asia, other countries. You know, Argentina is dealing with this as well. They have rampant inflation. They've been slowing and they're in contraction now. And do I think that they're necessarily going to cause a contagion between other banks that hold their assets? Probably not as much. But you look at some of the five major banks in Europe that hold Turkish debt, this is a very major concern. And so going to that scenario, if you follow that this could possibly be a contagion, you look at creditors are repricing assets and credit risk over in Italy. Look at the sovereign debt credit default swaps. Those are on the rise and at near-term highs. We still have yet to hear from Italy with essentially what their fiscal agreement will be, but I believe we'll hear that later this month. So there will be more information on that, hopefully. It's clearly in Europe's interest to see conditions stabilize for Turkey and Italy. I mean, there was French President Macron spoke over the phone this week with Turkey's president, stating that the importance of improving economic and trade relations with Turkey and France is very important to him. And he said specifically that he may be indirectly referring to BNP Paribas when he says that stability is very important to France alone. BNP Paribas is, again, one of those four or five European banks that has investments in Turkey. Now, look at the Euro Stoxx Bank Index. That's something that hit fresh year-to-date lows this week and will be a chart, Chris, I can definitely provide for our listeners on some of the attached materials for this episode. And it's been breaking down near term. And so, again, that's if you want to look at what is the possibility of contagion, look at the index, the price index on those banks, because that's exactly what that's telling us. The currency rallied after Monday due to some of these discussions back and forth and some of the policy statements and move by Turkey, but fell again on Friday when essentially the U.S., I think it was Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, was talking about increasing sanctions again on Turkey. So there's some political side to this as well.
So, Ryan, what else happened this week that was a driver? I know the S&P 500 rallied, maybe as a result of the lira rallying on the steps that were taken by Turkey's central bank. But what else may have driven the rally?
Well, Chris, we're still in the earnings season, and there were some actually pretty big players that announced this week. If we look at Walmart, Home Depot, Nordstrom in retail, all reported great results, and we had positive reactions to that in the market. JCPenney and Macy's, while they had good results, Macy's specifically, they did see a negative reaction in the market due to some profitability concerns. But overall, retail sales, looking at also coming out this week, we saw that there was some growth in July, up 0.5%. So I've been bullish on this story for a very long time since the fourth quarter of last year, looking at holiday sales. This continues to be an industry that I'm very much exposed to. I really like, especially in the specialty area and some of the restaurants, they've been performing well. Moving on, we did get some other earnings from, I think, Cisco and Deere, where we had some positive results. Caterpillar and Boeing, not necessarily on earnings, responded very positively towards the end of the week, maybe pricing in what many may be attributing maybe a bottom in emerging markets, really maybe being a little early here, but there were some good responses there. Looking more towards on the tech side of things, NVIDIA and Applied Materials beat expectations, but they lowered guidance for Q3. And that's concerning to me, Chris, because semis have been strong. They've been one of the strongest areas for 2 years. Tech has been leading. Semiconductors have been at the forefront of that. Of course, also some other big names like the Facebook and Netflix out there with content and social. But to see that they are starting to underperform, that to me threatens the cyclical view that the U.S. will continue to grow at a great rate and pace. This obviously could just be some profit taking, and that's pretty normal to any kind of a bullish move. But that's something that we'll need to continue to follow and look at closely. But looking at the whole industry, there are other companies that have shown similar weakness over the past month as maybe some aggressive investing takes some profits. But it certainly looks, to me at this point, like a topping formation and something that we need to watch to see if it clearly rolls over. But overall, it didn't seem to phase the market. Interestingly enough, on Friday, we did have a positive close, not only in the S&P and the Dow, but also in the NASDAQ was able to fight back. But this week, consumer staples, utilities, telecom services led on the gains. Those are not pro-cyclical aggressive sectors. Those are defensive sectors, which, again, like I said, really isn't a great sign for risk appetites. The other story that seemed to kind of lift stocks Thursday was a report from Bloomberg of an invitation from the Treasury to the Chinese, led by Vice Commerce Minister Wang, that is expected to arrive later this month. And, that caused the Dow Jones Industrial Average to have outsized gains, because if you look at where we've seen the most underperformance based on trade angst, it's been in those multinationals with large exposure to trade angst, tariffs, you name it. So that helped the market close positive for the week. So at the end of the month, you know, we want to expect some maybe some low-level trade discussions soon. The Super Bowl of trade, I guess, negotiations is planned not pretty far out right now in November between Trump and President Xi.
Ryan, you mentioned the retail sales figures were good for July. Were there any other economic announcements that did move the market?
Nothing really major. There, if we look at some of the surveys that the manufacturing surveys that were announced later in the week, there was some conflicting data. The Empire Manufacturing Survey rose to the highest level we've seen since October. I believe that level was around 25.6. And it was a sort of a Goldilocks type of report because it showed strong productivity at lower unit costs, which is strange. Our CPI is around 2.5% right now, year over year. But nonetheless, that was the case. And then there was the Philly Fed survey that came out a little later in the week, a humongous drop, falling, I believe, from the 20s down towards 11.9, its weakest reading since 2016. Some of the forward-looking components were strong, however, so maybe that's why it didn't raise too many concerns. But you'll hear more from Chris and I in the big picture. Probably we'll be looking at U.S. economic results. Oil had a big drop this week on a huge inventory build, something like 6.8 million barrels. And coupled with a breakout in the dollar commodities this week, really took it on the chin. We haven't seen copper this low in many months. Gold dropped to new fresh lows recently. So commodities really got hit hard. The dollar has been breaking out on a lot of what's going on. I think there's a 96% chance, based on the federal funds rate, that the Fed will be raising next month. And that's a more aggressive mode to raise interest rates a little quicker, four times instead of three times this year. But coupled with the breakout in the dollar and the commodities, really have just not been the place to be. But speaking of commodities, oil, it sounds like one news story that hit, I didn't see it really have too much of an effect, was that India is likely to cut its imports from Iran by about 50%. So, you know, that supply could stay locked or it could get shifted around. Who will know? We'll have to just continue to watch it. But commodities, short-term oversold. It'll be interesting to see if they bounce back next week.
Well, Ryan, we always appreciate your analysis on market-shaping events. In fact, I literally put aside this Wall Street Journal article to get your unique perspective. So thank you for that. We do look forward to your in-depth discussion with Chris Poplava in the second hour, The Big Picture. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
The rise in the dollar just destroyed emerging market stocks. They were market leaders up through about April, beating the S&P 500, and have just been demolished, and then are now down year to date overall. It's also just destroyed any international investments, even in the developed world. As those markets have done okay, but when you repatriate the strong dollar, they've ruined the returns, and it's made the United States, at least in for dollar-based investors, the unadulterated leader investment-wise this year, and provided a sense that the best place to be is the S&P 500 because it beats everything. And a big part of that is the U.S. dollar.
Should you buy and hold at market tops? At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe valuations, leading economic indicators, and other metrics are essential for prudent investing to both identify long-term opportunities and to minimize risk. Every day, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things that matter most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Give us a call at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, a registered investment advisor.
Well, since the beginning of the year, it's been almost like a one-story market. You've had technology stocks, everything from the FANGs to Apple becoming the first trillion-dollar company in history. But what about the rest of the market, the Dow Industrials? They're up, but not up as much. Joining me on the program is my friend Ralph Adcampora. Ralph, let's begin with Dow theory. We have the Dow Industrials. It hasn't come close to taking out its January highs. It's been going back and forth. You have the transports. We're looking a little better. But let's begin with Dow theory. What is that telling you?
Great question. I'm an old Dow theorist. And if you go back to the early part of this year in January, it was the transportation average, if you look carefully, that peaked first. And I believe it was a week or two later that the industrials peaked. That's called non-confirmation. When one goes to a new high, the other one has to follow within a short period of time. So the transportation never really followed. And then in late January, early February, we got this horrific decline. That was a 10% pullback. As I interpret Dow theory, that is a correction, a pullback, a secondary pullback, correction, in a primary bull market. Now, you're right, with all of what's been going on in the last 6 months, those averages haven't made new highs. They need to confirm each other by making new all-time closing highs. The closing price is the most important price for Dow theory. I'm still giving it the benefit of the doubt, Jim, that that'll happen. The transportation, as you just mentioned, looking a little bit better. If you look at the Dow industrials along with the transportation, you'll notice that it has been making a series of higher lows since April, May, and then June. And, you know, from a technical point of view, as volatile as the corrections have been, the industrials fighting the decline. So I still think it's a correction in a bull market, and we'll see what happens. But let me add something to the comment you made before when you say it's just the FANG stocks. Actually, it's a little bit more than that. You have the small and mid-cap stocks, the S&P 400 and the Russell 2000 making all-time new highs. So it's a little broader than that. But you're right, the old industrial kind of struggling a little bit.
So, Ralph, when you see the small-cap stocks and you see the power of the FANG stocks with valuations that if you look at, I don't care if it's Netflix or if you're looking at Amazon, even though they're great companies, you look at the valuations and they harken back to the late 90s. When you see stocks, and I think we have four in the group, you have Apple, the first $1 trillion company, and close behind it, you have Google, you've got Facebook, and you've got other companies behind it. When you see that, what does that tell you? Is it just telling you the strength of a particular sector, or is it getting a little crazy like it did in the late 90s when you look at some of these valuations?
You're right. When you look at valuations, you're not early, number one. When I look at the charts of some of these stocks, I literally get a nosebleed because they're vertical in the ascent. I think the first crack in the facade is Facebook. You know, that was a nasty decline it had few weeks ago, and it's really not recovering very well. So, yeah, I think that maybe that would be an early sign that, you know, we're getting close to, or, you know, we're in the area where a market top could form. However, when you compare it to the late 90s, you know, in the late 90s, you had stocks that looked like this, but they had no earnings. They weren't real companies, dot this and dot that. They deserve to get annihilated, which they did. These are real companies. That's the difference. You know, and Apple, you know, they still looks good. So if I owned many of these stocks, I'd hold. Facebook, I think I'd sell. But the others, I don't know if I'd be a buyer following your comment about valuation.
That is clearly a big difference. A lot of those companies in the 90s, heck, I can remember companies going public and doubling in a day, Ralph, and they didn't even have sales. All they had was clicks. In Apple, my goodness, they generate more money than any company in history when they're making the kind of money they're making. I want to talk about some of the sectors that have been leaders. You've had the consumer discretionary stocks been doing well all year. Technology, there are some of the favorite performers, and they've been consistent. But you also recently have seen a return with healthcare within the S&P is doing well. You've had a breakout with consumer staples, And even utilities have done a little better. When you see the more conservative side of the S&P start to break out, does that mean anything, or is this just a corrective bounce?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, because I'll be brutally honest with everyone. I've had days when I was really nervous, and I'd even call myself bearish. And there were days like yesterday, you know, when the market just turns in the anticipation of tariff talks with China, and, you know, things are doing better with Mexico. At least that's what they tell us. And you say to yourself, well, gee, you know, the market's coming back. It looks great. I'm conflicted. Again, I'm being brutally honest that, you know, when you see the utilities doing so well and the very conservative groups doing well, that's been a long time since I've seen everything going up like that. You know, the technology leading, and which is more aggressive buying. I think we'll look back a couple of years from now, or a year or two from now, and say, well, gee, this whole thing is part of a topping process. I wouldn't be surprised if us saying that. But, you know, having said that, that doesn't mean, you know, tops by definition are very volatile, and you'll get new highs in certain areas and others will just start to slowly fade. Like the number of new, when the technology is going to new highs, the number of individual stocks going at new highs is actually smaller. So there's internally, there is that deterioration. I hope I'm answering your question. I like the defensive areas. We have personally have exposure in the utilities, et cetera. And you're right about healthcare. So I think if you're a good technician, it comes down to one thing. Look at the individual stocks and sectors. And if they look good to you technically and they're in firm friends, stay with them. And if they start to get a little funny looking, you know, like Facebook and all, the discipline tells you, you got to lighten up a little.
I want to talk about something you mentioned. Maybe a couple of years from now, we'll be looking back in many ways the way we did in 2002 and say, oh my goodness, had I looked at the charts very closely in 1999, beginning of 2000, it looked like it was a topping process. As a technician with your years of experience, Ralph, what are key things that you look for that tell you, you know, as you mentioned, up until yesterday, you were personally getting a little nervous. So what are those things that make you nervous?
There's one thing the market abhors is failed rallies. When you get these exciting days and no follow through, and if that consistently happens, I get a little nervous. And that's, as I mentioned before, the number of stocks not making new highs in these rallies. That's a little disconcerting. And then you got stocks below their 50 and 200-day moving averages, again, being very, very technical. And that has been increasing. So under the surface, you see the conflict. It's not confirming. And I have to look at that. But again, as I made a comment a moment ago, you know what you own. You look at them carefully. And if they're in firm trends or solid consolidation patterns, hang in there. But once, you know, technicians, we have disciplines. And once you start to see them break down, you lighten up.
I want to bring up another Wall Street saying. I think maybe it was Edson Gould that said three steps and a stumble when the Fed, or maybe it was Marty Zweig, I'm trying to remember which, that when the Fed raised interest rates three times. Well, they've done that more, but of course, when you were talking about three steps and a stumble, you were talking about a Fed funds rate that was much, much higher. These guys started from zero. So it's widely expected, Ralph, they will raise in September in high probability in December. At what point do we get, with them raising rates on the Fed funds rate, that the market starts to get in trouble? In other words, yields get high enough that they're giving stocks good competition. Because up until recently, there was a saying called TINA, there is no alternative. Well, if you look at some of these, you know, whether you're looking at 2-year treasury notes, 5-year treasury notes, stocks are getting some competition. So does rising interest rates or a rising Fed funds rate with the Fed make you nervous as well?
I wish we had a video that we could show the long-term history of 10-year yields to the bonds. And if you go back, I have a graph. It's a 70-year history. And if you go back to the 1940s and 50s, rates were down in this area where we are, and then started moving up. And on this particular graph I have on top of that picture, I also have the S&P 500. And you can have rising rates and a rising stock market. Oh, sure, you'll have corrections and things. But the secular bull market in the 50s and 60s, early 60s, was going up with rising rates. Now, everybody, all the talking heads on television are so worried about 3%, 3%. That's not the line of demarcation. Historically, rates can go up, market goes up. Where the line of demarcation, the red line is not 3%, it's 5%. That secular bull market in this early, late 50s, early 60s ended when interest rates went above 5% long term. I still use that as my red line, if you will. And yes, I'll mumble around rates going up short term. And yes, people get nervous and they correct. It won't end the secular bull market we're in. For me, right, rates above 5%, the game is over. And if you'll remember your history, that bear market peaked in 1966. And for the next 18 years, the Dow couldn't get above 1,000 until 1983. That's when I came in the business, by the way. First 16 years of me in the business was me bumping my head up against 1,000. It was I had a headache at that time. So 5% is my line of demarcation.
We're not even close to that yet.
No, it'll be years away.
I want to talk about something else that we're seeing, and there's a lot of stories today about people in retirement. Retirement is different today than it was, let's say, 20, 30 years ago. Ralph, you and I know back in the year 2000 or 1999, if you were retired, I could get 6, 7% yields in safe investments very easily. That's not possible today. So let me bring up a hypothetical, and this may affect a lot of our listeners. You're retired, and let's say you have some good blue chip stocks, pay good dividends, high quality companies, a Coca-Cola, a Procter & Gamble, an Exxon. What do you do if you need income and you're retired and, you know, the market starts to go into a topping process or bear market? I mean, I can think of a story of Coca-Cola. In 2007, it peaked somewhere around $30 a share. By March of 2009, it was at 20. So you lost a 30-year value. But in 2007, 2008, and 2009, you got a 7% dividend increase every single year. And by the end of 2009, it was back up to 30. So what do you do?
I got to tell you something very personal. My lovely wife, Rosemary, was a financial advisor. And her whole thing was retirement. I mean, Rosemary retired several years ago due to illness. If not, she'd still be doing it because she loved it. And her clients called and called me and said, oh, my God, we're going to miss Rosemary. She's been so great to us. What she did is she tied everybody up, including us, in these high-yielding situations. And I remember in 2007, 2008, when that market started rolling over, I went down to Rosemary and I said, honey, I think we got to start selling this stuff. She said, please, we're in there for the long term. You told me that same story, Ralph, in 2000. And we went down with the market and went up with the market. If you're in those high yielding stocks, as you said, Coca-Cola or telephone, I don't know. We have more. And we just ride them out. And, you know, it kills me as a technician. You know, I see these breakdowns and tops and, you know, I'm looking, running for the hills. And her argument is, you know, you got to time it correctly getting out, and then you got to time it correctly getting in, and then you're paying taxes on your profits. And, you know, from a long-term investment point of view, people, you know, in the 60s and 70s, I'm 77 years old, and now we don't mess with anything. Oh, we have a few dollars. We'll play around with some crazy stuff. But by and large, the majority of our money is exactly what you described. And I'm saying this to everyone. This is personally what we've done. And thank God Rosemary was adamant about it and didn't listen to me turning the account. So I'm you know, I'm lucky enough to be able to buy the family farm. And if not, I think I'd be a cow on the farm.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing, and I just want to point this out from a planning point of view, if you take somebody that's in a high tax bracket, they're paying 23.8% in federal taxes. If you live here in California, you can pay 13.3%. So if you add those two together, if you sell, Ralph, you have your own guaranteed correction. It's called taxes, which could be as much as 40%. Where if you just keep the dividends, you might be taxed at 15 and 20%. You know, maybe you just hold on to it. Couple other questions, if I may. Does the breakdown that we've seen in emerging markets, the strength of the dollar, does that have you concerned in any way? Because we do know a rising dollar hurts the sales of many of the companies that are in the S&P and let's say the Dow that are international companies, and the problems it's creating for countries like Turkey and elsewhere. Does that concern you?
Yes, that's another concern. I'm glad you brought that up. You can live with a strong dollar for a while, but talking about nosebleed charts, you start looking at the dollar versus some of these other currencies, and my heavens, they're way beyond the pull of gravity. And at some point, that's going to affect large multinational companies in the United States. That's the danger we run with all these tariffs and all this tariff war that's going on. That's the bad news. The good news is it's telling people like in China, I think I heard this on TV yesterday, that $1.4 billion, am I right, came out of China last week because people are fleeing their currency. And, you know, they're looking for a safer haven. So the U.S., if you look at just the stock markets of these countries, even in Europe, I mean, look at Germany and places like that. You know, if I were in a plane flying at 30,000 feet and I'm saying to the pilot, all right, let's land somewhere where I can invest some money. You know, that plane would land in Kennedy Airport in New York City. It's not going to land in London or Paris or something like that. The U.S. is still the safest market in the world. Having said that, the problem with that is that the flight to currency at some point will be a problem. You know, as I said earlier, I said, you know, we're going to look back a year or two from now and look back. I said, well, the market was churning all. And part of the our observation will be, gee, look at that strong dollar. It impacted the market eventually. Yes.
Ralph, if I was to sum up right now, if I was to best describe it, you're a little bit nervous because of the things we discussed. But right now, your charts tell you to give the markets the benefit of the doubt. And for our long-term investors that own high-quality stocks that pay good dividends, just sit back, collect your checks and dividends, because even if they go down, strong quality companies always come back.
Thank you. In summary, I'd say that I don't see the secular bull. Now, let me define secular. Secular means something. A secular bull means a rising market that 10, 15, 18 years in duration. And this secular bull that we're in now started in March of 2009. So if it were just 10, 11, 12 years, you got a couple of years left, theoretically, okay. But we have cyclical, that's spelled with a C, cyclical corrections or cyclical bear markets. Now, if we're in the processing top, which we just spent a bit of time arguing back and forth, the pros and cons of this thing, I'd say it'd be a bear market within a secular bull market. I'm not looking for the end of the secular bull market. As I mentioned about interest rates, they've still got a long way to go before they hurt the stock market. And I don't see major tops in a lot of individual stocks like the FANGs and all those stocks. I just don't see it. And the secondary stocks, I don't see it. But having said that, yeah, I'm nervous because there are things that are just not falling into line just yet. And I think the fly in the ointment right now is what really happens with these talks in domestically and internationally with tariffs. If that works out, I think you're going to get another run to the upside.
Ralph, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you. All the best to you, your wife, and family, and have fun on the farm.
Thanks, sir.
You betcha.
Bye-bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
If you add up the triple Bs to the high yield bonds, the traditional junk bond market, to leveraged loans, which are even higher risk paper, you get to this $5 trillion total. And that compares to the rest of the investment grade universe that I think truly is investment grade universe of $2.5 trillion. So I would just suggest to investors that they be very careful about how they view their quote unquote safest fixed income holdings in their 401ks, in their IRAs. We've been down this path before. We recall that subprime mortgages were also rated as high grade.
Well, for commodity investors, it hasn't been the best of all years. Gold is down to almost levels that we haven't seen since 2017 or the lows of 2016. Is there a future of gold? And is there anything that would be a catalyst to launch it? Joining me on the program is Keith Barron. He's CEO of Aurania Resources. Keith, let's talk about gold for a minute, because as I look at the charts on gold, gosh, we finally broke 1,200. It looked like there were several attempts since last year, but the dollar is much stronger right now. So what's your take on gold as you look at where it is today?
Well, I think gold and commodities in general are pretty volatile. And I think what's going on is a temporary phenomenon. We've had a bit of a correction. What's happening right now has been due to the problems with Turkey and with the strength of the American dollar. So, there have been rumors out there that the Turks have been selling their vast gold holdings to support their currency. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I think perhaps that's what's precipitated what's going on now. But, you know, these sorts of things happen from time to time, and people shouldn't get overly anxious about it. There are corrections in the market, but the gold price, as we've seen over the years, has always bounced back, and it will bounce back from present levels right now.
Keith, let's talk about the gold industry itself. And I've had several experts that have basically said, you know, one of the problems that gold has right now is it has competition. For example, cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, other cryptocurrencies, and even in the mining space, money is not going into, let's say, junior exploration companies like they did, let's say, in the last cycle, in the last decade, because there's so much more competition. The big thing in Canada right now is cannabis companies.
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, it's a little bit of a redux from, 2000. And in that time, the popular thing were the tech stocks, and there are a lot of things out there that were questionable in terms of economics and growth and all the rest of it. But the public were largely in love with these things, and so the gold space was neglected. A lot of the venture capital that would normally go into junior mining enterprises was going into crazy things like buying dog food in bulk online and all kinds of nuttiness that went on. And we saw the NASDAQ blow up, and a lot of steam was blowing off. And that was really the rejuvenation of the gold market around 2001. And then we saw it, of course, move ahead. But then start to pick up steam in about 5-6 years. And so what we're seeing right now, I think, is no different really from that time. We've got the public being enamored with Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, and in Canada, as you say, with cannabis stocks. I think it's a temporary thing. In Canada, cannabis will be made legal for purchase on October 17th this year. And then after that, I think you're going to see a lot of these high-blown, crazy notions that the business is going to earn pots and pots of money. Forgive the pun. And things will fall to earth. We'll see a lot of consolidation, and I think people will realize that the business is not going to be as profitable as everyone is expecting and hoping it to be today. I think in terms of the cryptocurrencies and all the rest of it, if I had any kind of knowledge of the dark web and hacking and all that stuff, and then certainly I do not, I might tend towards nefarious activities. I should think that a lot of the best hackers in the world are trying to break into cryptocurrency and steal the huge amounts of money that are sitting there. And I think it's just my personal opinion, but a moment will come in time, and there have been scandals, notably in South Korea, where you'll see huge amounts of money that are swiped, and that'll be the end of cryptocurrencies. I personally will not invest in something that can't be explained to me in three sentences or less. And I quite frankly don't understand cryptocurrencies, and I'm not going to take the time to do it.
Let's talk about gold in one sense as its traditional role. It's served well in terms of extreme periods of financial stress and deflation, as we saw in the 30s. It has done well in periods of inflation, as we saw in the 70s, and also in periods where you have tremendous demand, as we saw emerge from the emerging markets in the last decade. So, Keith, this is an investment that has been around as long as recorded history. It served as a store of value. It still is. I mean, if you take a look at central banks, they own dollars, they may own euros, but they also own gold. So as you look at this as a traditional type of investment, what, in your opinion, would be a catalyst that might drive the price up? In other words, a supply and demand, maybe something with the dollar. Because certainly there is no fear in the markets that would drive people into gold right now.
Yes, well, certainly mankind has valued gold as precious going back more than 5,000 years, even further back than recorded history, before history was even recorded. So it's an intrinsic thing in our culture. It's pretty much baked into who we are. And certainly in Eastern cultures, it is revered very, very much more than perhaps in Western cultures. It's always been considered a store of wealth in places like China and India, and will continue to be. That is not going to change no matter what happens with cryptocurrencies and all kinds of hocus pocus that's going on right now. But the fact of the matter is, Jim, that there are more people on this earth than there ever have been before. And a certain number of them are going to be interested in gold and will be gold buyers. And they want to keep a portion of their wealth in gold, especially, as I mentioned just now, the Eastern countries. And that's not going to end. That's not going to change. So against that backdrop, we have a situation where less gold is being found. And I have lectured over the last 3 years about something that I call peak gold. And we will reach a situation probably this year where in future there will be less gold mined than there has been at present. So we've reached the pinnacle, the zenith, and from here on out, no matter what we do and no matter how hard we look, there's going to be less and less of the yellow metal produced. And that's simply because the low-hanging fruit, as we call it, has been picked. Most of the Earth has been trodden over by geologists and looked at, and it's getting harder and harder to find things that are fairly close to the surface where we can mine. You know, we can't go down to the center of the Earth. We are constrained by what we can do really within the top couple of miles of the Earth's crust, and that's it. And once that's once that's exhausted, it's exhausted. It's gone. The gold will still be out there in some sort of form once it comes out of the ground. And gold does not get destroyed. Unlike other metals, it doesn't get consumed in chemical reactions and things like that. It's inert. So all the gold that was ever mined in history is still somewhere there on the surface. You know, the pieces of pie are spread up, split up in so many more different ways than in the past. And I think that is what's going to be ultimately the driver of the gold price, simply because at some point you will not be able to get a hold of it.
Keith, what does this mean for the industry itself? If you believe, as you do, that we've reached peak gold, we're discovering less of this stuff, not to mention the fact that even if you were to discover or make a major discovery today, the environmental permit processes, dealing with governments and things like that, it could take 8 to 10 years to bring a mine in production. So what does this mean for the gold industry itself? I'm thinking of, you know, large producers like a Newmont or a Barrick, which is shrinking. What does this mean for the industry?
Well, this has been the problem of the industry over the last couple of years. The reserve base has been falling steadily of collectively of the gold mining, senior gold mining companies. And that is very difficult to reverse. The only way really that these companies can catch up is by mergers and acquisitions, by going out and acquiring junior companies or their peers. And, you know, we've seen this in the past. Homestake is gone. Normandy Mining is gone. Placer Dome is gone. These have all been absorbed over the years by other players. So the field has got a lot smaller. So that being said, it is getting harder and harder to find places to go and prospect for gold. There are more and more national parks around the world. There are lots of areas that are considered to be environmentally sensitive, especially in the USA, the good old USA. If you were to have a mining project, you are a target by every special interest in NGO, they typically these days don't go after the actual mining companies, but they go after the government agencies that have permitted them, like the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service. You know, if you were to find a nice gold deposit in California today, it's not going to take you 8 to 10 years to get the thing permitted. You could almost certainly say never. it's going to be very, very difficult to make it happen. Now, other jurisdictions can be very different. There are parts of Canada that are very receptive to exploration, and even parts of the USA. I'm talking to you today from Montana, the state of Montana, and they've had a ban in place for almost 20 years now for the use of cyanide in the recovery of gold. And what has that meant? It's meant that any large-scale gold mining project cannot get off the ground in this state. This is the situation. You know, there are a lot of places around the world that the industry would love to get into and explore, but they're just off limits. Either off limits because they're protected areas, or it is just too difficult to fight the forces that are stacked against you.
Well, Keith, we know that every ounce of gold that has ever been mined still exists today, but you have new uses for gold every year, jewelry stores still want to sell jewelry, and you use gold in various things like electronics. So what is this? I guess maybe if I hear you correctly, eventually the demand for gold is outstripping supply. Sooner or later, the supply characteristics are going to kick in, much as we saw with oil before the discovery of horizontal drilling and shale, leading up to, for example, in the late last decade, when we saw oil prices jump to 150. So as we have discussed in previous interviews, you don't see anything technologically out there that could maybe bring more gold to the surface or allow miners to extract more gold from existing mines. So let's turn to the other side of supply, which is exploration. As you mentioned, we are discovering fewer and fewer discoveries. They're not elephants like the past, but let's talk about the exploration industry of which you're a part of, because you just don't see the activity in juniors as you once did in the last decade when money was flowing freely into the sector. Today, a lot of those companies are all gone. Some of them turned into cannabis companies. So let's talk about the exploration front and what's going on there, because you don't see much activity.
Yeah, well, the activity is there, but it's rather muted from what it's been in the past. And that is a consequence of funding, getting the funding to do the work. It is expensive work. It's very technologically intensive. In the most cases, it's just not simply old-time grizzled prospectors with a mule and a pick and a shovel walking across pieces of property and yelling Eureka. There's sophisticated remote sensing techniques, geophysics, geochemistry, all kinds of things that are brought to bear, and lots and lots of drilling to see what's in the subsurface. And these are all pretty expensive endeavors. The exploration business has really been forced to go to the fringe frontier areas to go and find areas that may be prospective to find the deposits I call elephants, and these are things that are going to be 10 million ounce plus deposits. They're very, very few and far between. You know, a dozen years ago, we used to find maybe two of them every year. There haven't been any of them found for several years now, and this is the problem. But you have to go to the areas of this planet, the remaining areas that haven't been looked at or haven't been looked at in a very hard sense by mining companies. They don't have a long history. The senior mining companies, when they do their exploration, they typically do what's called brownfields exploration. And their feeling is, you know, if you can't throw a rock from an existing headframe, from an existing mine, and hit a gold prospect, they're really not interested. They want things that are close to infrastructure, close to existing mills and everything, and they're not willing to spend their exploration dollars to go too far afield from things that aren't already known. The type of people, the exploration folks who are, well, in the oil business, we would call them wildcatting. We don't have a similar sort of term for them in the mining business, but I'm one of them, and I like to go out into frontier areas and do exploration in places that really haven't been thought of as targets by previous people, or that have had a hard look at them by mining companies. And these are the places where you have the possibility still of finding these elephant-type deposits. Not areas that have been gone over for 60, 70 years, like, let's say, the Timmins Camp in Northern Ontario in Canada. You have to go into these new areas to find new stuff. They're There are very few of them left. There's not many of them, and it doesn't look like we're going to get to the moon or Mars very soon. So, we have to make the best of what we can, what we can reach.
And Keith, in final question, the new frontier areas, or I guess those parts of the globe that haven't really been touched or explored, where do they exist? Because, I mean, at one time, South Africa was the number one gold producing area in the world. But as we know, gosh, they're going down almost to the Middle Earth to even extract gold. And there's a limit there. Their production is down. Production in the U.S., I understand, is down because, as you mentioned, it's very hard to get permitting for anything when it comes to mining. So where are those frontiers left?
Well, I would think that in the U.S., the only real frontier areas are left in Alaska. Internationally, I could think of Siberia in Russia, maybe the Congo in Africa, Brazil in South America. I'm working myself with my company Arania in Ecuador in a frontier area that actually had never been previously explored except by petroleum companies. And we've been finding indications of gold and indications of porphyry copper in the area. And this is very exciting for us because these things have not been looked at and walked over and really reviewed in detail by any pre-existing mining company. They're really virgin areas.
So, Keith, as you look at the gold market right now, we've got competition coming in from cryptocurrencies. If you look at the mining space, there's competition coming for juniors from cannabis companies. As a gold investor, what would you be doing? Would you be investing in an ETF, an individual company, or we just simply make it simple and buy the bullion itself, if indeed what you're saying, it could become scarce?
Well, I think you should do a little bit of all those things. Certainly, the ETFs are very interesting. I think that where I would put my dollars would be in some of the companies that are focusing on picking up royalties. And of course, there's a number of those companies. And those are good bets because they're diversified. They really have very little exposure to things political problems or problems with environmental disasters or earthquakes or anything like that. So they're diversified. But at the end of the day, the junior mining companies are the ones that will give you the biggest bang for your buck. My previous company, Aurelian Resources, which is no longer around, went up 9,000% when we discovered the Fruta del Norte gold deposit. That was a huge, huge, massive win for us. But I can run off numerous things over the years, like Hemlo, like La Perina, many gold discoveries where the mining companies suddenly went from pennies to multiple tens of dollars, and then were eventually acquired by the majors. So, you know, I've often said this, and I really believe it, the junior mining space is somewhere it can be as lucrative as cocaine smuggling, so I've heard anyway, but it's perfectly legit, and you can turn a piece of pretty much worthless moose pasture or a piece of jungle into something that's suddenly worth billions of dollars, if not approaching trillions. Where else can you do that in any kind of industry around the world, in any kind of endeavor? So you have to pick your companies in the correct way. You have to review the management. Management is a key. See if they've got a track record and see where they're working, if you like the jurisdiction, and if they're cashed up and to do the exploration. It's not enough to have just one of these sorts of pillars. You have to have the whole combination. You can't just have the real estate, or you can't just have the management or the money. You have to have all three of them. So if you can put them all together, you like what you see, potentially down the road, you're going to be a real winner.
All right, Keith. Well, listen, as we close, you have two websites, one Aurania, the company that you currently head up, and you also have another website, Straight Talk on Mining, where you've written numerous articles about the mining industry and, the companies themselves.
Well, straighttalkonmining.com is still active. It has been since 2001. I've got a lot of stuff there, a lot of commentaries, though I don't get a lot of time to write these days. But you can certainly take a look at that and download the material. The company website is aurania.com. That's spelled A-U-R-A-N-I-A. And take a look at the company. And if you like what you see, you can always fire me off an email and I can answer any questions you have.
All right. Well, listen, Keith, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
You too, sir. Thanks very much for the opportunity. Bye-bye.
We want to thank you for joining us for the first half of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture, Ryan and Chris Poplava discuss the international trigger points that may set off a correction in global markets. They look at Turkey, Italy, the U.S. dollar, and technical concerns regarding outperformance in defensive sectors of the market. Stay tuned for Hour 2.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.